friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Monday, August 30th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Our first story comes to us from Rona Faborg with an airplane theme and a golf simulator, golf simulators. Flight Bar and Grill is set to take off in Huxley this fall. Matt and Mary Ann Potch's dream to open a restaurant will launch this fall as Flight Bar and Grill. It will open along the north side of Huxley. With a name and a theme inspired by the local Ballard School District's mascot, the Bombers, Flight takes off with several references to airplanes. The Ballard Bombers mascot is a B-52 airplane, so we want to tie into that, Mary Ann said. And we plan on offering a lot of different kinds of flights, beer and other different fun flights. Maybe some food flights, maybe some flights with wine, things like that. The business's name's nod is to the community, and it's also an indication of the type of atmosphere that the Potches are looking to foster, a hometown place where everyone feels welcome. The Potches have lived in Huxley for 4 years and are originally from a similarly sized town in eastern Iowa. They have a son, Warren, who will be 2 years old in November. When we moved to Huxley, we felt right at home, Mary Ann said. We've tried to immerse ourselves in the community, and we're really looking forward to raising our kids here. We want to be really involved and give back to the community through our business as well. Flight will offer a wide selection of menu items like burgers, sandwiches, flatbreads, salads, and appetizers. It will also have 24 beers on tap and a diverse selection of liquor and wine. Flight will feature the restaurant and bar on one side, and it will have a state-of-the-art golf simulators on the other side. People can order food and drink, and they can play on the golf simulators, Mary Ann said. The areas will be connected from the inside and will also have separate entrances from the outside. There will be a lounge area in golfing space, and customers will be able to reserve tee times. With Ballard Country Club just down the street, we thought during the off-season people could have a winter league on the simulators, Mary Ann said. The Potches are planning other fun activities like bags tournaments and other games on the patio, live music, and other fun community events. Community is a big part of the atmosphere that the Potches want to cultivate. We're less than half a mile from the football stadium in Huxley, so we plan on having tailgate events before the games and also some post-game specials, Mary Ann said. Will be a great place for people to congregate after all Ballard athletic events. Flight will have carry-out options, and online ordering will be available. Curbside pickup will be available, and in-house customers will be able to order electronically from their tables. We're going to be a kid-friendly, fun place where people can come and bring their family, she said. We'll also be a place where you can come and wind down with a drink. This is the Potches' first foray into the restaurant and bar business. Matt has recently been operations manager for the Lincoln Center Hy-Vee in Ames. So he's not new to the food industry, but this will be a new venture for us as far as opening our own restaurant, Mary Ann Potches said. The location is a new strip mall being constructed along Highway 69, north of the Fairway store. The new development is called The Landing, and Flight will occupy the last space on the far north side. We'll be the very first one as you come into town, right behind the Welcome to Huxley sign, she said. We'll have a large patio that overlooks a retention pond as well. The interior will have an industrial feel with some exposed brick and polished concrete floors, Mary Ann said. We think it will be a really good atmosphere where people can bring their children. We'll have a kids menu, she said. We'll also be a place to transition at nighttime for adults to come and enjoy a night out for a date night. Next, we have a story from Philip Sitter. Iowa State and the City of Ames revive a partnership to educate off-campus students on being good neighbors. Ahead of a traditionally party-heavy weekend that drew a lot of criticism last year for large crowds, Iowa State University and the City of Ames officials canvassed neighborhoods around campus on Wednesday. They're hoping to impart some advice on safety and being good neighbors. Known as 801 Day, the Saturday before the fall semester begins traditionally involves large gatherings that begin as early as 8 o'clock in the morning. University officials described this week steps that we're taking to try to avoid a repeat of last year, when large crowds of unmasked and not socially distanced students and a spike in COVID-19 cases concerned university, county, and city leaders. Some of those steps will include having staff present to provide guidance, masks and hand sanitizer, as well as providing alternative activities. But also, the canvassing Wednesday under the university and city's Good Neighbor Partnership. Joel Hochstein, the assistant director of Iowa State's Office of Student Conduct, said, "Canvassing was first done in 2019, but not last year because of the pandemic." Hochstein said about 250 rental units were reached in 2019, and the goal Wednesday was to reach 380 rental units. Whether anyone answered a knock on the door that afternoon, canvassers gave out drawstring bags and not only contained a few goodies like candy, a sleep mask for the eyes, not the face, a pen, but also information including on how to avoid problems with neighbors, theft, and alcohol when throwing or heading to a party, fire safety, mental health first aid, and the ability on campus of COVID-19 vaccinations. That's the availability of campus-centered COVID-19 vaccinations. Sarah Van Meetren, a building official with the city's inspection division, said, "The list of properties to visit in 2019 was determined by overlaying the city's list of rentals with addresses where students receive letters from the university's student conduct office." This year, Van Meetren said, canvassers just went off the city's overall list of rental properties, meaning some non-student Ames residents were included as well. The efforts were limited to single-family homes and duplexes and did not include apartment buildings or dormitories. Hochstein told canvassers ahead of time that they were trying to encourage neighbors to talk to one another before involving the police or security for nuisance issues. He said the overall hope is to educate students on their responsibilities and the expectations of them as community members to be courteous and respectful. "Ultimately, yes, we would like to reduce the amount of nuisance issues that are happening," he said. "Let your neighbors know if you're going to have a bunch of people over. That's going to affect parking. That's going to affect noise." Kurt Kruger, an Ames Police Department community resource officer, said, "City and campus officers plan ahead for the weekend and put as many officers as they can into areas where they know people will be partying." Kruger said his biggest advice for having people be safe at a party and not having the event become a nuisance is for hosts to limit the number of people at the party to 20 or less, and only people they know. Hunter Niels, a senior studying agricultural business and economics, he answered the door to canvassers, said he expects there to be parties this weekend, but his residence is not having one this year because of liability issues. "Overall for the coming year," Mellis said, "I just hope things are back to normal." Toya Younger, Iowa State Senior Vice President for Student Affairs, who also went along for some canvassing Wednesday, said, "We know that people will want to get out. They want to see their friends. They've been trapped at home for long periods of time. We're really trying to educate our students to take personal responsibility. That's really what this is all about this year, Younger said of the canvassing, as well as her overhope for what this weekend looks like compared to last year. She said the presence of her and other staff and police this weekend will not be punitive. It'll just provide some guidance and some direction. Our next story's title, A Marine from Red Oak, Iowa, among those killed in Afghanistan airport bombing. The family of a 23-year-old Marine who grew up in Southwest Iowa, said Friday he was among 13 U.S. service members killed in the deadly bombing at the Kabul airport this week. Corporal Dagan William Tyler Page, age 23, served in the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment, based at Camp Pendleton, California. He died along with 12 other service members, 10 of them from the Marines, a Navy hospital corpsman, and an Army soldier, when a suicide bomber detonated explosives near the airport gate. As many as 169 Afghans were also killed, and another 18 United States service members were injured. According to the Omaha World Herald, Page's family released the following statement to local news outlets. Our beloved son, Corporal Dagan William Tyler Page, 23 years old, was killed in Afghanistan yesterday. Dagan joined the United States Marine Corps after graduating from Millard South High School. He loved the brotherhood of the Marine Corps and was proud to serve as a member of the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton, California. Dagan's girlfriend, Jessica, his mother, father, stepmother, stepfather, four siblings, and grandparents are all mourning the loss of a great son, a grandson, and a brother. Dagan was raised in Red Oak and the Omaha metro area. He was a longtime member of the Boy Scouts of America. He enjoyed playing hockey for Omaha West Side in the Omaha Hockey Club, and he was a diehard Chicago Blackhawks fan. He loved hunting and spending time outdoors with his father, as well as being out on the water. He was also an animal lover with a soft spot in his heart for dogs. Dagan always looked forward to coming home and hanging out with his family and many buddies in Nebraska. To his younger siblings, he was their favorite jungle gym, and to his friends, he was a genuinely happy guy that you could always count on. After finishing his enlistment, Dagan planned to come home and go to a local trade school, possibly to become a lineman. Dagan will always be remembered for his tough outer shell and giant heart. Our hearts are broken, but we are thankful for the friends and the family who are surrounding us during this time. Our thoughts and our prayers are also with the other Marine and Navy families whose loved ones died alongside Dagan. In the story, there are pictures of each of the other 12 United States soldiers who died in the bombing incident at Kabul Airport. I'm going to read their names. Let's see. Lance Corporal Dylan R. Mirola, age 20, of Rancho Cucamonga, California. Corporal Hunter Lopez, age 22, of Indio, California. Corporal Kareem M. Nikoi, age 20, of Norco, California. Staff Sergeant Darren T. Hoover, age 31, of Salt Lake City, Utah. Corporal Dagan W. Page, 23, Omaha, Nebraska. Sergeant Johnny Rosario Picardo, age 25, of Lawrence, Massachusetts. Corporal Humberto A. Sanchez, age 22, of Logansport, Indiana. Lance Corporal David L. Espinoza, age 20, of Rio Bravo, Texas. Lance Corporal Jared M. Schmidt, age 20, of St. Charles, Missouri. Lance Corporal Riley J. McCollum, age 20, Jackson, Wyoming. Navy Corpsman Maxton W. Sovak, age 22, of Berlin Heights, Ohio. And Army Staff Sergeant Ryan C. Canus, age 23, of Coryton, Tennessee. Not pictured is Sergeant Nicole L. Gee, age 23, of Roseville, California, who was also killed. Our next story comes to us from Rana Faborg. With a roaring 20s theme, Huxley gears up for Prairie Fest. Huxley's Prairie Fest is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and it looks just a little bit different this year, according to a Facebook post by the celebration committee. We tried to make it as normal as possible, but you will see some things missing from the schedule, the post stated. Because of COVID-19, the video game trailer was not available. Also, it has been replaced with a rock climbing wall, which will be open from 11 to 10 p.m. That's 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. at Railroad Park. Some other events, such as sand volleyball and horseshoes, are not on the schedule due to low interest and a smaller than normal committee, the Post stated. Our next story comes to us from Isabel Rosario. Remember, everybody is somebody's someone. International Overdose Awareness Day commemorated. After his sister, Tassara Burnside, died from an opioid overdose in 2016, Devin Terone said he found his strength within their mother. She has my unrelenting support. We've been each other's rock since day one, he told a crowd of nearly 50 people at Ada Hayden Park in Ames on Saturday. Natasha Terones organized the event to commemorate International Overdose Awareness Day, which is observed globally on August 31st. Her advocacy is motivated by how much she loves both her children and being so honored that they call me mom, she previously told the Ames Tribune. Attendees on Saturday learned how to administer naloxone and heard from mothers whose children died from drug overdoses. The overwhelming message, there is help available and there is nothing to be ashamed of. When Denise Ryder's 19-year-old son Dalton died of an overdose in 2016, she said she felt embarrassed at first. She wanted people to remember his talent for wrestling and love of driving sprint cars. She was afraid he would be judged. I talk about it all the time now because we do need to end the stigma, Ryder said. They're still human and they still have someone who loves them. Drug overdoses killed 93,000 people in the United States last year, a record high number that was 30% more than the death toll in 2019, according to provisional data from the CDC. In Iowa, opioid-related deaths increased by 35% from 2019 to 2020, when 212 deaths involved opioids. Preliminary research shows a correlation between overdose deaths and pandemic isolation. Ann Breeding supported her son, Daniel Bailey, through 12 years of addiction before the 29-year-old died of an overdose in November. Bailey had an adventurous free spirit and the biggest heart, according to his obituary. Breeding told the crowd Saturday to remember, everyone is somebody someone. When you're kind to someone, regardless of who they are, what they look like, what they've been through, it has an effect on the mother that sits at home crying, because someone cares about that child, Breeding said. Advocates with Community and Family Resources, where Terones is a board member, also distributed free vouchers for naloxone at the event. The medicine rapidly reverses an opioid overdose. When Burnside overdosed on the synthetic opioid U4 nearly 5 years ago, Ames police officers on the scene did not carry naloxone. Shortly after Burnside's death, that changed. I do not know if the outcome would have been different if we were carrying it that day or not, but it certainly convinced us that it was the right time to do that, Ames Police Chief Jeff Huff said. Now all of our officers carry Narcan, a brand name for naloxone, in their vehicles. That's one positive thing that has come out of this tragedy. Sally Carnes, Operations Director at Community and Family Resources, emphasized that treatment for substance abuse is available and overdoses are preventable. The biggest thing I think we can all do is help break down the stigma. That stigma eventually stops people from getting treatment, Carnes said. We should not be referring to people as addicts or substance abusers. They are people with substance use disorders, just as someone is a person with diabetes. Natasha Torone said, it can still be difficult to get out of bed knowing that Tassara, the girl with the love for music, who sang so beautifully, is not here. But she has a newfound family, she says, that she does it all for. I do it for the Daniels. I do it for the Frankies. I do it for the Richards, the Daltons, everybody, Torone said. My feet are planted. I am not going anywhere. These are places you can find help for addiction. Community and Family Resources has offices at 1619 South High Avenue in Ames, and also at 1332 South Marshall Street in Boone. For more information, you can call 866-801-0085, or you can email them. Their address is information@cfrhelps.org. Iowa has set up a referral system called Your Life Iowa. The free program links Iowans with counselors, and they can refer them to a range of treatment options. You can go to their website, that is yourlifeiowa.org, or you can call them. Their number is 855-581-8111, or you can text 855-895-8398. Next is the National Institute on Drug Abuse. They provide a research-based guide to treatment principles with answers to frequently asked questions. Next is a free booklet for families, What is Substance Abuse Treatment? That booklet is available from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Our next story comes to us from Daniel Gehr. The heart and soul of an Iowa State University program, referring to Pat Miller, who elevated the lecture series, but students were her focus. Whenever the nearly 40-year-old director of Iowa State's lectures program was asked which speaker was her favorite, Pat Miller always said, the next one. Miller, who brought speakers like Noam Chomsky, Cesar Chavez, Leslie Odom Jr., Mitt Romney, and Angela Davis to Iowa State, repeated this line because she was always looking ahead, said Molly Helmers, who worked for Miller from 2006 until Miller's retirement in 2018. At 72 years old, Miller passed away August 15th due to complications with ALS. Now she is being remembered for her devotion to students and taking the well-respected lectures program at Iowa State to national recognition. I do think that one of her goals was to showcase Iowa State, Helmer said. But I also think one of the greatest things about what she did was it was very student-centered. She was all about what lectures would contribute to the student experience. Helmers, who now works in Iowa State's honors program, said Miller's brain never seemed to turn off. She was talking at you as she walked through the door, Helmer said. Sometimes I wonder if she ever slept. Miller was a constant news consumer, reading magazines like The Atlantic and The New Yorker, Helmer said. Her constant intake of information meant she always knew which figures to bring to campus. Oftentimes, right before their popularity catapulted, current lectures program director Amanda Creve said, she was really good at finding people just before they became big names and was usually able to get them at a really good cost, Creve said. Another key to Miller's success was her tenacity, Creve said, and apparent quality as she spent 29 years trying to bring activist and Handmaid's Tale author Margaret Atwood to Iowa State. Miller made her first attempt in 1988 to bring Atwood to Ames, according to Inside Iowa State, later using birdwatching and the 3,000-pound Iowa State Fair butter cow to draw her to Central Iowa. In 1992, Miller introduced herself to Atwood at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, to which Atwood responded, "Ah, the butter cow." Another 24 years passed before she spoke at Iowa State. Miller surmounted a similar long-term battle to bring the much-requested Bill Nye, the science guy, to Iowa State. At the 2017 celebration of the lectures program's 60th anniversary, speakers were unable to separate the program from Miller. "We really can't spotlight the program without some of that light being reflected onto her," Mary Greeley spokesperson Stephen Sullivan said at the anniversary celebration. "Pat has been at the heart and the soul of this program," Iowa State Provost Jonathan Wickert said at the celebration. "You're really synonymous with the success of this program, Pat." Born in Des Moines, Miller first moved to Ames in 1973 with her husband Kemp, according to an obituary. In Ames, she first worked at the Iowa State University Press. She later obtained her bachelor's in psychology while caring for her two young children. And in 1981, she became an assistant to the university lecturer's program. Aside from big names brought to the university and the notoriety of the lecturer's program, her greatest impacts were with people. Sullivan also said at the 60th anniversary celebration, "Meeting Miller is like meeting a galaxy," which he coined the Miller Way, filled with a network of students and former students, faculty, staff, her family, friends, all of them connected through her. This was because Miller was a brilliant networker, as well as a beloved mentor to generations of students, Helmer said. Helmer said even in retirement, Miller continued her involvement with the lectures program, helping where she could, Creve said. In her first year as director, Miller was a constant resource. She was a mentor and a friend to thousands of students, and I don't think we can overestimate the impact that she had, Creve said. Our next story comes to us from Rana Faborg. It's in the category of Iowa Mourns. Vince Olson, known for helping others. Goosebumps grew on Mason Olson's arms as he watched a bald eagle soar over his backyard. He'd never seen one fly so near to the Olson home before. His father, Vince, a Vietnam veteran, had always admired bald eagles, always paused to take in their beauty. Earlier that morning, on January 9th, Vince died from COVID-19 in Ames. He was 71 years old. He died at 1:24, and the eagle appeared at 9:17 in the morning, said his wife, Cheryl Olson. Born in Eldora, Vince was drafted to Vietnam at the age of 18, just days after eloping with Cheryl, and he served until his honorable discharge in 1969. He stationed with a crew that loaded and unloaded Agent Orange into United States planes. "Sometimes it was dripping off of him," Cheryl said, adding the exposure caused a myriad of health problems as he aged. Vince wrote Cheryl every day while she was abroad, she said, often asking about their oldest daughter, who was born during his deployment. The day Vince flew home from Vietnam, a woman spit on him from the other side of the escalator. "These poor kids, they went over there, they fought, And then to be treated like that when they got home, Searle said, it was heartbreaking. After the war, Vince was a long-haul truck driver, and he worked for the Story County Secondary Roads Department for 31 years. When not on the job, Vince found time to coach youth soccer, and he volunteered for the Nevada Fire Department, where he served as assistant fire chief for 12 years. Vince was a very hard worker, Searle said. He always worked two jobs. He used to work 100 hours some weeks. Vince was known for helping people, even random strangers. His daughter, Britt, said, he had a lot of integrity. He would do the right thing when no one was watching, Britt added. If a car was broken down right over there, he would be there with his head under the hood with them, Mason said. If someone was hitching, he'd pick them up. Thinking of the many hitchhikers the family picked up over the years brings easy smiles to their faces. It's a tradition Mason continues this day. I picked a guy up on my way to Minnesota last week, he said. He was Australian, and I took him to Mason City. But more than anything, Vince loved to be with his family, his three kids, nine grandchildren, and Searle's niece and nephew, to whom he was a father figure. At Easter time, he bought all of the kids a new bike, and those two got new bikes, too, she said. They went on every vacation with us. They basically went about everywhere with us. Vince's early war experiences made him grateful for every day, his family said. Even if you were broke and eating beans and weenies or whatever, he still loved it, Mason said. There is a tranquility to that, a stability. Since Vince's death, the Olsen family has seen multiple bald eagles. Each one offers a moment to pause, just like Vince did, and take in the sign that their beloved patriarch is still with them, still watching over them. They have been chasing me around a little bit, Mason said. I was in Minnesota, and one would come out every day and be over us. Even the guys at work would be like, hey, Mays, there he is. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Kermit Leroy Dirks. A celebration of life service will be held for Kermit Leroy Dirks on Saturday, September 4th, at the United Church of Christ in Ames. Visitation will begin at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the church's parlor, followed by the service at 2 p.m. Masks are required at United Church of Christ. A private family interment will be immediately follow the service. In lieu of flowers, Kermit's family requests that donations in Kermit's memory be made to Trudy Dirks, who will use all donated funds to support Friends of Aden Hayden Heritage Park and the United Church of Christ. Kermit passed away on May 12th at the age of 86. That was in 2021. He is survived by his wife, Trudy, his son, Bill and Tammy Dirks, and his daughters, Terry and Leon Hillers, and Kathy and Paul Simpson. He was also blessed to have 8 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren. Online condolences may be directed to the Grandin Funeral and Cremation Care.com. Our next obituary, Charlene Alice Crabtree Michael, 80 years of age, passed away peacefully at home August 23rd of dementia. She is survived by her husband of 62 years, Carol, nicknamed Slick, a daughter, Christine and Steve Schoenhorst, 2 grandsons and 1 granddaughter-in-law, Kurt and Kanna Jones, and Brent Jones, 2 great-grandchildren, Cage and Riley Jones. She was preceded in death by her son, Randy Michael. Celebration Life Iowa has been entrusted with her cremation care. Our next story comes to us from Philip Sitter. The West Nile virus is found in Ames. The city aims to control mosquitoes. The city of Ames plans to fog local parks to control mosquito populations after West Nile virus was detected. Tests indicated mosquitoes trapped at area parks were positive for the virus, and mosquitoes that could potentially carry it are likely still present in the community, according to a city news release on Wednesday. Iowa State entomologist Professor Ryan Smith said, "This is getting to be what's historically been the peak season of West Nile transmission. Indications of those mosquitoes are not anything new, but these test results provide an opportunity to remind people to take precaution when they are outdoors," he said. He advised that residents remove standing water from flower pots, buckets, barrels, and wear mosquito repellent or long sleeve shirts and long pants outdoors, especially at dusk and at dawn when West Nile transmission mosquitoes are most active. Most people infected by West Nile show no symptoms, and though only a small amount of people develop severe illnesses, people who fully recover may experience several weeks of fatigue, according to the release. There were only 3 cases of West Nile virus reported in Iowa last year, none of them fatal, according to the CDC. There were 664 cases reported across the continental United States, and 52 of those cases were fatal. Joshua Thompson, Ames Superintendent of Parks and Facilities, said, "Due to the lack of rainfall this summer, staff has not completed any larvicide and fogging in the parks. Larvicide kills mosquito larvae, and fogging targets adult mosquitoes." The positive test results for West Nile mean that fogging will begin at locations where virus-positive mosquitoes were found, Thompson said. Fogging will take place between 8 o'clock in the evening and 10:30 p.m., rain and wind permitting. In case of inclement weather, the fogging will take place between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. weekday mornings. Our next story comes to us from Sarah Jordan Hines. The Boone County Hospital sees the impact of the Delta variant. The Boone County Hospital continues to limit visitors and require the wearing of masks. "It's pretty obvious the Delta variant is spreading," said Joe Smith, hospital administrator and chief executive officer. "We are fortunate that we've had as many people vaccinated in the community as we have. For the 65 and older, it's over 90%. He said the hospital's walk-in clinic has seen an increase in traffic since last month, mainly due to COVID-19 and seasonal allergies. "We're not anticipating that will it get as bad as it was in Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Missouri," he said. "We think the reason that is the case is because of our higher vaccination rate. We have the capacity to take care of folks in the hospital and the clinics. We've purchased 6 to 10 portable air scrubbers, and basically we're filtering the air between patients at a really high safe level. Staff can also meet parents at their vehicles to limit time in waiting rooms." Smith said he encourages people to get vaccinated. He said he knows some people are hesitant. "Serious side effects are extremely rare," according to the CDC. Earlier this summer, Mercy One Medical Center, Broadlands Medical Center, Unity Point Health, and the Veterans Medical Center announced they would mandate the vaccine for employees beginning November 1st. "It's something we're considering at the Boone County Hospital. I cannot say when or if we would," Smith said. "We're talking to our board, medical staff, and employees. There are people who are adamant every hospital employee should have one, and there are people who are equally or more adamant that should never happen. Regardless of what we do, there will be people who disagree." Smith said hospitals fear losing good employees if such mandates are implemented, and those workers then resign. "Quite honestly, I don't remember a time when staff has been as difficult as it has been over the last 4 to 5 months," he said. "It's a real rock and hard place situation." Smith said the Boone County Hospital has received calls from folks employed at other hospitals that have mandatory vaccination, asking what the Boone Hospital policy is. The difficult part for us is we're just not in a situation where we can guarantee that one way or another. It's a fluid situation, he said. Smith said as hospitals fill with COVID-19 patients, it grows harder to serve people with heart issues, accident victims, seasonal flu cases. I think the hospital is prepared, but hospitals in Des Moines are getting pretty full. It's a good time to really protect yourself, he said. We've had a situation or two when it was very difficult to get a patient transfer because no one in Des Moines had room. To register for a COVID vaccine, you can go to theboonehospital.com. That's www.boonehospital.com. Or you can call the Boone County Public Health Department Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Their telephone number is 515-432-1127. Next, we have the Nation and World Watch. From Charlottesville, Virginia, a transgender man held at a woman's prison in Virginia is suing state prison officials after being denied breast removal surgery. Jason Yoakum, who is serving sentences for murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and a firearm offense, says the denial by the State Department of Corrections violates his constitutional protection against cruel and unusual punishment, and his right under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Yoakum was diagnosed with gender dysphoria in 2017. From Mexico City, Tropical Storm Nora is rolling towards a brush at possible hurricane strength along Mexico's Pacific coast and the Baja California Peninsula over the weekend. The United States National Hurricane Center says Nora is strengthening and could bring dangerous flash floods and mudslides through the weekend. Nora may head up to the Gulf of California, also known as the Sea of Cortez, but before that, it is likely to stay offshore but graze the region around Puerto Vallarta on Saturday and the Los Cabos Resort region on Monday. Next, from Karachi, Pakistan, a massive fire broke out at a chemical factory on Pakistan's southern port city of Karachi on Friday, killing at least 10 workers and injuring several others, police and a government spokesperson said. It was not immediately clear what caused the blaze in the congested Miran town neighborhood. Television footage showed firefighters dousing the flames as ambulances continued transporting victims to a government hospital. Government spokesperson Mutaraza Wahabi said officers are investigating what caused the fire. And from Banda Aceh, Indonesia, three critically endangered Sumatran tigers, including two cubs, were found dead in a conservation area on Indonesia's Sumatra island after being caught in traps apparently set by a poacher, authorities said Friday. The mother and a female cub were found dead Tuesday in the Lusir ecosystem area, a forested region for tiger conservation in Aceh province. That according to August Arianto, head of the conservation agency. The body of a male cub was found on Thursday, about 15 feet away, he said. Next, we have a story from Annapolis, Maryland, and the Associated Press. Maryland's highest court has agreed to take up the case of Lee Boyd Malvo, who is serving life in prison for his role in the 2002 sniper spree that terrorized the Washington, D.C. region. Malvo's attorneys argued that his punishment goes against a 2012 Supreme Court ruling barring mandatory life sentences without parole for juvenile offenders, and Malvo should benefit from Maryland's new law enabling prisoners convicted as juveniles to seek release once they have served at least 20 years. The State Court of Appeals granted a bypass review in Malvo's case and that of two others serving life sentences for crimes committed as youths, according to news outlets. The order issued Wednesday scheduled oral arguments to begin in January. Malvo was 17 years old when he and John Allen Muhammad embarked on a killing spree that left 10 people dead and 3 wounded in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Others were killed as the pair made their way to the D.C. region from Washington State. Muhammad was executed in 2009. Next, we have a story from Iowa City, the press citizen there. An inmate who pled guilty to the killings of 2 Anamosa State Penitentiary employees was sentenced Thursday to life in prison during a hearing filled with emotional statements by surviving victims and families of those who died. Thomas Woodard Jr., age 38, is one of 2 inmates who were charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in the beating deaths of Anamosa employees Lorena Schulte and Robert McFarland. A trial is scheduled for September 21st for his co-defendant, Michael Dutcher, who was indicated in a court filing that his argument will be either that the killings were in self-defense or in the defense of others. Woodard has acknowledged killing McFarland, who was 46, a corrections officer at the prison, and Schulte, age 50, a nurse at the prison infirmary, on March 23rd. He also admitted to severely injuring another inmate, McKinley Roby, and aiding Dutcher in holding dental assistant Lori Mathis against her will. Among the 11 people who spoke during Thursday's hearing at the Jones County Courthouse in Anamosa or submitted impact statements were the McFarland's mother and Schulte's sisters. She was always able to help me see the best in difficult times, reminding me that you can get through anything, said Schulte's sister, Gretchen Dixon, fighting back tears. In exchange for his plea, Woodard, who chose not to speak at the hearing, will be transferred to Nebraska, where his family lives, to serve out his sentence. He pled guilty August 6th to 2 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of attempted murder, and 1 count of second-degree kidnapping. Authorities said the attacks occurred as Woodward and Dutcher tried to escape through a window in a break room at the infirmary. Through impact statements read by others at Thursday's hearing, Robbie and Matthews each told how the trauma they suffered has affected them. Whether you want to hear it or not, that day has changed me, left an emotional impact on my life, my trust in others, Robbie said in his statement. My anger and fear level has changed, all because of what happened to me on March 23rd. I don't know about you, but I'm going to go on in life once I work my issues out. Matthews, who spent 29 years, has been treating patients for the Iowa Department of Corrections, said in her statement that she will not forget what happened that day. Never have I had to witness or go through such a horrific tragedy as what I was put through on that day, she said. It is forever embedded in my head. She said she would not recount the details out of respect for the families of the victims. You have stolen from me part of my family that is now forever changed, she said in a section of the statement addressed to Woodard. I do not feel you have 1 ounce of remorse for all the lives you have forever changed by your inhumane acts of violence. Authorities have not said Matthews was assaulted, but she said in her statement that she has suffered broken ribs and bruising and a hematoma on her leg. The broken ribs led to pneumonia in both lungs, she said. My body may have healed from the injuries I sustained that day, but my mind is forever altered. I struggle on a daily basis from the mental wounds that are still open and fresh. The healing process is not something that is accomplished in a short amount of time. My only wish is for prayers and healing for all of us affected by this tragedy. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Washington, D.C. The Federal Reserve will start dialing back its ultra-low rate policies this year as long as hiring continues to improve, according to Chairperson Jerome Powell. He signaled the beginning of the end of the Fed's extraordinary response to the pandemic recession. The Fed's move could lead, over time, to somewhat higher borrowing costs for mortgages, credit cards, business loans. The Fed has been buying $120 billion a month in mortgage and treasury bonds to try to hold down longer-term loan rates to spur borrowing and spending. Powell's comments indicate the Fed will likely announce a reduction or a tapering of those purchases sometime in the final 3 months of this year. In a speech given virtually to an annual gathering of central bankers, as well as academics, Powell stressed that the beginning of tapering does not signal any plan to start raising the Fed's benchmark short-term rate, which has been kept near zero since the pandemic tore through the economy beginning in March 2020. Rate hikes will not likely start until the Fed has finished tapering its bond purchases. However, Powell said inflation has risen enough to meet its test of substantial further progress toward the Fed's goal of 2% annual inflation over time, which was necessary to begin tapering. There has also been clear progress, he said, toward the Fed's goal of maximum employment. At the same time, the Fed chair said the central bank is monitoring the economic impact of the highly contagious Delta variant, which has caused a sharp spike in COVID-19 cases in the U.S., especially in the South and the West. While the Delta variant presents a near-term risk, the prospects are good for continued progress towards maximum employment, Powell said. He spoke via a webcast to the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium, which is being held virtually for a second straight year because of COVID-19. On Wall Street, investors appeared to welcome Powell's message of a gradual withdrawal of the Fed's economic support beginning this year, and his view that surging inflation pressures will likely prove temporary. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose a sharp 225 points, in other words, 0.6%, soon after Powell spoke. The sharp jump in inflation has put the Fed's ultra-low interest rate policies under growing scrutiny in Congress and among ordinary households that are being squeezed by surging prices. Inflation, according to the Fed's preferred gauge, rose 3.6% in July, compared with a year earlier, the biggest increase in three decades. The month-to-month increase slowed from 0.5% to 0.3%. In his speech, Powell underscored his longstanding belief that while inflation has surged, causing difficulties for millions of Americans, the price acceleration should ease once the economy further normalizes from the pandemic and supply shortages. History, he said, suggests that the Fed should not overreact to temporary price spikes by undoing its support for the economy too aggressively. Doing so could weaken job growth. Next, we have an opinion piece by David Masito. He writes for USA Today. The title is "Please Help My Family, I Beg You, A Plea as Bombs Fall in Kabul." Omad was all in for Americans even before September 11th. His family had been driven out of Afghanistan by the Taliban, and he knew our futures were intertwined as he learned English in a Pakistani refugee camp. Back then, he would have freely used his full name because the Taliban had yet to threaten him, and he did not fear for the lives of his family. When the United States quickly invaded Afghanistan after September 11th, Omad's father moved the family back to Pagam, outside of Kabul, hoping for a brighter future. That's where he met his first Americans. He befriended the soldiers as he interpreted for them without his family's permission. Now, Omad is in a refugee center in the United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, after a flight Tuesday out of Kabul under the cover of darkness. As we talk and text over WhatsApp, fighting a bad internet connection, Kabul is rocked by twin blasts that claim the lives of at least 13 U.S. service members and wounding 15. His first and last words are, "Please help my family, I beg you." Because of the violence in Afghanistan, USA Today is not using Omad's last name or identifying his family. His family is hidden, he says, sure that they are targets, just as surely as the service members who died trying to help Americans and Afghans alike escaped the Taliban. Ahmad's family fears Taliban reprisals for his work with the Americans and with the United States-backed Afghan government so recently overthrown. It does not help that his 25-year-old sister is a law student. Ahmad's family wants to join the tens of thousands of Afghans the United States has already rescued in the last-ditch effort, spearheaded by 6,000 United States troops at the Kabul airport amid a constant stream of military and civilian evacuation flights. Surrounded by Taliban gunmen who control access to the airport and threatened by Islamic State bombers who want to turn the embarrassing withdrawal into a rout, the days until a Taliban-imposed red line are running out. And that brings us to the conclusion of reading the Ames Tribune for this Monday, August 30th, 2021. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to Iris.